Welcome to the Burn Bag Podcast. My name is Andrew Gonuola, being joined by Ryan Rosenthal and our friend Javed Ali today. Javed is the former senior director of counterterrorism on the National Security Council during the late 2010s. He's had a significantly long and distinguished career in counterterrorism efforts in the federal government. And Javed is joining us here today on a very spontaneous note because we received big, big news yesterday that the United States has killed the leader of Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri. Big news. Javed, I guess, what are your first initial thoughts on this operation?
Ryan, Andre, always great to be with you guys. And you've done such an amazing job with the podcast, so always humbled to be on with you. But starting with the impact of the strike, I mean, this is a major achievement in the annals of U.S. counterterrorism, similar in impact to the ground operation against the former Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden in 2011. And then over the past decade, there have been other similar high-value target operations against ISIS leaders. If your listeners remember in 2019 under President Trump with the leader of ISIS at the time, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, another ground raid. And then under President Biden this year, then the person who had the mantle for ISIS, Ibrahim al-Qureshi, was also killed in another ground raid in Syria led by the U.S. So this is a continuation of these high-value target operations, either from the ground or the air. We've seen multiple capabilities used. But Zawahiri is a really interesting character for lots of different reasons, because like bin Laden, I mean, they were responsible for the creation of Al-Qaeda stretching back to the 80s and late 80s in Afghanistan, the formal merger between Zawahiri's group at the time, the Egyptian Islamic Jihad, and Al-Qaeda didn't happen until 1998, so almost a full decade later. But bin Laden and Zawahiri first met each other on the ground in Pakistan and Afghanistan at the height of the conflict against the Soviets in the 1980s. And then those personal relationships between the two evolved for nearly 30 years after that. And even though I would argue that Zawahiri was not the same leader of Al-Qaeda that bin Laden was for the decade after bin Laden died, he was still a very influential guy in his own right, even if the personality was different and even if the demeanor was different. So again, very significant from a U.S. counterterrorism perspective. And now one of the interesting questions going forward will be who will be named as Zawahiri's successor. Will that person bring the same type of jihadist credentials that both bin Laden and Zawahiri had, even though they were sort of different people? And then what does this mean for the future of Al-Qaeda as an organization, or at least that legacy organization that started in Afghanistan in the late 1980s? These are all open questions, and we don't know the answers to them, but I think these are ones that your listeners should start thinking about now.
Yeah, and before we kind of get there, Javed, I want to also circle back to why this is such a big deal, because al-Zawahiri, of course, most people probably think of Osama bin Laden as the mastermind behind 9/11 and you know, many other attacks against the United States or other kind of U.S. interests in the Middle East and around the world. He was one of the masterminds behind 9/11, if not the mastermind behind 9/11. And so can you kind of walk us through, I guess, the significance of that, right? How al-Zawahiri has kind of been behind the scenes.
Well, I would push back on one thing to a degree, and this seems to be kind of making the rounds of the media right now, is that Zawahiri was head and shoulders more responsible for 9/11 than other very senior people in Al-Qaeda at that point. I don't think that's been proven by the known record, and I would point to the 9/11 Commission report as the most authoritative document on the history of Al-Qaeda and what the organization was doing on 9/11. So I'm not dismissing how important al-Zawahiri was, but I also think it would be a mistake to say that he was the principal architect of the 9/11 operation. But that being said, Zawahiri has his own jihadist legacy going back to his time in Egypt in the 70s and 80s. And that is where he began his own journey into that world of jihadist action, first very locally focused on undermining the Egyptian state, which culminated in the attack against then President Anwar Sadat in 1981. And al-Zawahiri was a key member of this group called the Egyptian Islamic Jihad that was responsible for that attack. And then he and other Egyptian jihadists, even those outside of the Islamic Jihad group, were thrown in jail by the Hosni Mubarak government, the person who came into power after Anwar Sadat was assassinated. And they were sort of lumped together in these pretty cruel conditions. And that probably led to a deeper sense of radicalization and grievances, not only against Egypt, but perhaps other countries in the West. There's this classic YouTube video that your listeners can find about Zawahiri from behind these prison bars in Cairo after they're all these jihadists are locked up, sort of ranting against the Egyptian state, Israel, the United States in perfect English. Just shows you how sort of talented he was. He was also came from a prominent family, very successful. He was a medical doctor. So this was not, someone who was down on his luck throughout his life and came from a hard scrabble background. He was a dedicated, committed jihadist who's also had this revolutionary mindset. But then once a lot of those folks got released from prison in Egypt in the 80s, then they went to Afghanistan to get into the fight there. That's when that nucleus started to form for this international jihadist movement, which became Al-Qaeda, sort of a plankholder by 1988. That started that relationship with bin Laden. And then Zawahiri and the Egyptian Islamic Jihad were responsible for a series of either disrupted plots or successful attacks in Egypt, in Pakistan. There's an indication that Zawahiri had some role, again, hard to say if he was the principal planner, but definitely a role in attacks like the 1998 East Africa Embassy bombings, the USS Cole. And then by June of 2001, even a few months before 9/11, the group that he was the head of, the Egyptian Islamic Jihad, formally merged with Al-Qaeda in 2001. And by that point, 9/11 had been in motion for almost 2 years and just a few months away from actually being sort of executed by the attack team that was here in the United States. So I guess this is a really long way of saying Zawahiri, even prior to 9/11, was deeply involved in the jihadist scenes, both in Egypt and then at an international level, and someone who sort of turned his back on this very privileged lifestyle that he had, or the upbringing that he had and the education that he had, to become a very different person.
So I'd say the good news of yesterday is that, okay, we killed the leader of Al-Qaeda. That's always great news when we do that. But the bad news is that he was found smack dab in the center of downtown Kabul. And there's a lot to dissect with the fact that he was found in Kabul, which is now under Taliban control. But also, like, the strike itself, I believe it was a very precise, it was like a very precision missile type strike, hit him and killed him while he was standing on a balcony, killed no one else. So Javed, it's not like the house like blew up. It's not like we blew up the house. We just sort of killed him. And I was reading on the news that this is a type of missile that has these sort of knives that sort of stick out of the missile and essentially just target the one person, not really the surroundings. So can you sort of explain that? Because I think for our listeners, you think drone strike, you think bomb and explosion, but this is a bit different, at least for our listeners, in terms of what they might have been hearing.
Well, I don't want to comment on the capability that was used until the government officially acknowledges what capability was used. But suffice to say, I mean, the U.S. has developed a series of attack methods over the past 20 years that are supposed to be very precise and lethal and designed to attack the target. And in counterterrorism, it's usually an individual or a group of individuals, and not create a broader swath of destruction to physical buildings or create civilian casualties, because those things are completely counterproductive. And they also play into the jihadist narratives that the U.S. doesn't care about the lives of Muslims and those that attack. So regardless of whatever weapon was used again in the strike, it seems to have been very precise, designed to only kill Ayman al-Zawahiri. And President Biden put his credibility on the line yesterday and said that there were no civilian casualties, and apparently the building wasn't further damaged. So that I think speaks to the way this particular operation was designed. But I just can't comment on the precise capability, because I, for one, don't know what was used. But getting back to your first point about the safe house of the location being in Kabul, yeah, that is a big deal, because it appears to show that that Doha agreement that the Taliban made with the Trump administration in early 2020, and part of that agreement was that they would sort of not use or let Afghanistan become a launch pad for external operations the way it had become in the late 90s and then through 2001, when Al-Qaeda had taken sort of roost there after they left Sudan in the mid-90s and came back to Afghanistan, then that seems to be a repudiation of that. And not only that, apparently the house, this is based on media reporting, that Zawahiri was in, was a house at one degree, if not directly, tied to Sirajuddin Haqqani, who is one of the senior officials in the Taliban right now. So it doesn't give the Taliban much of a leg to stand on to say that they rejected Al-Qaeda, that they weren't giving safe harbor or shelter to senior people, to include someone that has been a known figure in the jihadist world in Afghanistan, as I've mentioned, for 30 plus years. And what this means for the U.S. relationship with the Taliban going forward, another open question to which we don't know the answer. But I think that was part of the messaging that the president used yesterday, is to put the Taliban on notice that this was a red line. And despite whatever agreement the U.S. had worked out with the Taliban, that we would still reserve the right to conduct unilateral operations against people like Zawahiri if we were able to build the intelligence picture and ensure that there would be no or limited civilian casualties. And those are all things that appear to have happened with the strike.
So Javed, of course, you know, Haqqani is the acting interior minister. That certainly demonstrates that at the very least, they probably knew, or if not, they were harboring him deliberately and intentionally. Probably the more likely story. We don't know. I'm sure more will come out. Nonetheless, it's very clear that the Taliban have now kind of reneged on their agreement. And that, of course, means that the United States can, you know, engage in its own kind of retasking of policy priorities. But I do want to talk about Al-Qaeda going forward. So, of course, when you see the death of a leader, there's different implications. There are also many different leadership styles by leaders. As you said, Bin Laden is quite different than Zawahiri. But who's really next in line in the succession for Al-Qaeda leadership? And what would that kind of, how may that change Al-Qaeda as a terrorist organization?
Yeah, it's another great question, Ryan. And again, we don't know the answer to that. So, and I gave a lot of media commentary last night, and I've got other media opportunities lined up even today. But one thing I've been saying consistently is even if taking the strike against Zawahiri off the table, prior to that, that legacy Al-Qaeda organization that was responsible for attacks in the 90s and then 9/11 and then other plots into the 2000s, that legacy Al-Qaeda organization has been torn apart. Mostly by this relentless campaign of U.S. counterterrorism operations and pressure against it. So there's very few people left from that old guard Al-Qaeda that could theoretically step up. Now, there are some individuals. Some of those individuals are currently in Iran. Their ability to operate freely is an open question while they've been in Iran. But could the new Al-Qaeda leader come from there? What kind of management structure do they have left that's either in Iran, Syria, Afghanistan, Pakistan. We don't know how this degraded Al-Qaeda organization works as well as it did or as much as it did in the past. And so if on the one end there's a rapidly diminishing pool of senior figures with the standing and the bona fides in that legacy Al-Qaeda world that could rise up, if the choice isn't going to come from there, could it come from one of the several Al-Qaeda affiliates that still exist around the world? Which is another point I made in these interviews or have been making, is that despite this battered and bruised legacy Al-Qaeda organization, there are still viable Al-Qaeda affiliates in Yemen, in Syria, in Somalia. There's again the degraded Al-Qaeda organization in Afghanistan, Pakistan. There's an Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent as well, which is sort of separate from the core Al-Qaeda. So, and then there's Al-Qaeda elements in Africa outside of Al-Shabaab. So would we see a leader emerge from one of those groups too? I think that's less likely, but it's hard to rule anything out right now.
So sort of building off of that then, I guess because for our audience who may just be watching, you know, mainstream news and all of that, you know, we've heard about Al-Qaeda all throughout, you know, the first decade of 2000 since 9/11. And then in 2014, ISIS was sort of the big, you know, evil sort of entity in the Middle East. And we've been hearing a lot about ISIS. And now we don't really hear too much about counterterrorism, as I guess our country's focused in terms of the commentary has at least shifted towards, you know, great power competition. So my question is, building off of that, you said that there are still many Al-Qaeda affiliates, you know, all across the world. There's one in South Asia, there's some in Yemen, and so on. So reiterating, like, is this as big a deal then as some folks are framing it, right? Like, for some in our audience, perhaps they might think like, oh, okay, we killed the leader of a dying organization. But you just said, of course, you know, there are still affiliates who are doing operations. So I guess, what's the state of Al-Qaeda today in general across the world? Are they still as vociferously conducting these terrorist operations as they used to be? Are they still, say, powerful, say, vis-a-vis ISIS? What's going on there, just for our audience?
Well, Al-Qaeda, again, the vanguard or the legacy Al-Qaeda organization that emerged out of Afghanistan in the late 80s, that group is in a probably its weakest state since it was created in 1988 because of all the deaths and captures of individuals associated with that organization. And their ability to launch external operations has been, for the most part, destroyed. Al-Qaeda, that legacy Al-Qaeda organization, hasn't tried to launch a spectacular or ambitious terrorist plot since the late 2000s. I mean, they really haven't had much capability, but that's because of that, of this relentless counterterrorism campaign that I've talked about. But the affiliates have been more successful at generating plots. Most of them are locally focused and regionally focused, and that's why most of your listeners probably haven't heard of them, because they don't get a lot of front page coverage here in the United States. But make no mistake, these groups are still around, and they have hundreds, if not thousands, of people in them. I mean, look at Al-Shabaab in Somalia as a perfect example of that. Very locally focused group, mostly made up of ethnic Somalis, although 15 years ago there were more foreigners with foreign fighters with Al-Shabaab. But again, mostly Somali orientation, locally focused on sort of exerting its influence in the country. They're not trying to rule the country, but they're trying to exert influence where they have territory. They haven't declared a caliphate the way that ISIS did. And they have also gone through a pretty brutal series of strikes against them by the United States, with a ground force from a collection of African countries. But here we are 15 years after the formation of Al-Shabaab, and they're still again, it's a very viable group. They don't seem to suffer from a lack of recruits. They seem to be able to generate revenue through all these business schemes or financial schemes they operate on the ground. And is that a group that would ever change their targeting focus from the local one that they have, which has included the death of Americans and attacks in Somalia and Kenya, to a transnational one? And that's always been an open question with a group like Al-Shabaab, and we'll see if that changes. And then if you shift gears to a group like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, again, very much attached to the Al-Qaeda brand because they've never dropped that from their name. At their heyday in the late 2000s, they were also focused on external plots against the West, against the United States. They tried to, if your listeners remember, the underwear bomber of Christmas Day 2009, that was a plot directed by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula based on some unique capabilities that they had or unique people associated with the group. A year later, they tried another planes-related plot. They tried to put bombs in cartridge toners and send those cartridge toners to different destinations in the United States. Thankfully, those plots were stopped, but if successful, those cargo planes would have exploded in midair somewhere and crashed. But since then, they've also likewise been more locally and regionally focused, but also very lethal. So I don't think yesterday's attack means that this is the death knell for the affiliates. It may mean that the legacy Al-Qaeda is in a battered shape, but I think the affiliates are, for the most part, and have been for the most part, operating on their own. And unless those groups change their orientation to attacking the United States or U.S. interests, as you mentioned earlier, Andre, I don't think the U.S. is going to be engaged in counterterrorism campaigns as aggressively as we have in the past, because our national security priorities are shifting to other things, or have shifted to other things.
Well, that's a very interesting point, Javed. I want to ask you one more question before we wrap today, kind of in that same vein. This strike certainly demonstrates that the U.S. has the capability to conduct over-the-horizon operations. And in the wake of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, many experts were concerned about the viability or the capability of the United States should the U.S. be fully out of Afghanistan. But I'm curious as to what your opinion and thoughts are about the ability for the United States to conduct operations, even though we are kind of easing back from heavily engaging in Middle Eastern counterterror operations.
Yeah, that's a great question. And once the withdrawal was announced, I was one of those people who was saying, let's make sure that we preserve some capabilities to protect our national security if targets of opportunity emerge, or if plots are detected that have an anti-US or anti-Western focus. Even though there are trade-offs involved in that. So it looks like that we have been able to successfully collect intelligence for an operation like this for some period of time. And President Biden said in his remarks that the intelligence picture on Zawahiri started almost 6 months prior. And so that's an interesting revelation that there was an intelligence lead to this, and we must have used different capabilities to develop that picture and get a fairly high level of confidence that it was Zawahiri in that building, and then come up with an operation that would be able to successfully execute whatever sort of objective or mission was directed by the president. And again, that meant there was a capability that was used, and Andre hinted to what that capability could have been. Again, I don't know precisely what it was. So that also to me suggests that we have capabilities in the region, even if they're not positioned in Afghanistan directly anymore, and that for these very limited types of operations, we can use them and deal with whatever trade-offs are required in order when you have to use those either intelligence or operational capabilities for something like this. But the types of sustained campaigns that we engaged in the years past, those days are probably gone in a place like Afghanistan, because we just don't have the in-country presence anymore.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, as U.S. policy changes, so do our capabilities and operations and how we conduct them. But nonetheless, it is great news to see that the United States conducted this operation successfully. No sort of cost that we know of on the U.S. side. But Javed, thank you, as always, for joining us and sharing your thoughts and professional experiences. Again, we appreciate your insights and analyses, as always.
All right, Ryan, great to be with you. Thanks, guys.